So welcome. How's the volume on this? Everybody can hear in the back? Good. So Rodney Smith asked me to lead the talk tonight, so I feel honored and happy to be up here. And tonight I'd like to share and explore a sutta, one of my favorite suttas, called the Bahiya Sutta, from a collection called the Udana Suttas 1.10. So Bahiya was a sage. So he was an ascetic who also is known as Bahiya, the bark cloth. So he wore, I guess, bark-shaped clothing. So that's what he used to kind of help, you know, in those days, often people had a sense of trying to punish the body to help become more spiritual. And he was quite renowned. He was worshipped. He had people bringing him food and medicine, and all his needs were taken care of. He was really at the top of the spiritual game back then. Okay? So he was at the pinnacle there. So one day he was sitting in his cave by the seaside, meditating, and just the thought came to him, well, am I awakened? And if I'm not awakened, am I on the path to being awakened? And this guardian spirit, this devata, I guess at one point was related to him, I'm not sure how all that works, but he was related to him, and came to him, and it sensed what he was wondering about. And he said, and she said, actually, Bahiya, not only you're not awakened, you're not even on the path to being awakened. Now, you're not even, what you're doing is not even going to lead to being on the path. Okay? So what he did then was very interesting, because he could have just said, okay, I'm just going to dismiss this person, because all these people who are worshiping me and honoring me, they obviously see something that's special about me. You know, why should I disregard that, give up all my authority, all my power? But he did something very unusual. He was willing to let go of all of that. And he asked her, well, who is awakened? Who can I ask to get teaching from that? And she said, well, there's this guy named the Buddha, who's, you know, over there. So he dropped everything he was doing and walked, you know, a day and a half to reach him, just nonstop. So he finally got to where the Buddha was staying, and he came to the forest where there were his sangha was, and there was a bunch of monks doing walking meditation. And he asked, "So where's this Buddha?" He asked it a little bit more politely than I'm saying, but so they said he went to town to get alms. So he's going through his alms round. So Bahiya went to town and found the Buddha, and he went down on his hands and knees and said, "Please teach me the Dharma, you know, for my own well-being, for my long-lasting benefit." And the Buddha said, "Now's not a good time. I'm in the middle of trying to get alms. You know, I haven't eaten since noon of the day before. I'm hungry." I'm adding a little bit to it, but you know, it's probably what he was feeling. You know, he was busy. So Bahiya said, "Please teach me the Dharma, because we don't know what danger lies you or me in the future. How long we have to live." And the Buddha again said, "You know, not now, Bahiya. You know, come back after alms, and I'll teach you." And finally, for a third time, Bahiya said, "Please teach me, because I do not know how long we have to live. What danger may befall you or me." So finally, the Buddha, on the third time, said this. "Then, Bahiya, you should train yourself thus. In reference to the seen, there will only be the seen. In reference to the heard, only the heard. In reference to the sensed, only the sensed. In reference to the cognized, only the cognized. That is how you should train yourself. When for you, there will only be the seen in reference to the seen, only the heard in reference to the heard, only the sensed in reference to the sensed, only the cognized in reference to the cognized. Then, Bahiya, there is no you in terms of that. When there is no you in terms of that, there is no you there. When there is no you there, you are neither here nor yonder nor between the two. This, just this, is the end of suffering." Okay. So that, in that simple few words, the Buddha lays out the whole path. You know, this is one of the most direct teachings I've heard from him. And the Buddha is pointing toward this place of awareness, this pure awareness, That's when our judgment, our sense of opinion, our contraction, the sense of I doesn't arise. Where there's a sense of saying that there's nothing added to this moment. The moment is completely fine as it is. There's nothing we're adding with our judgment, our cognition, our thinking, and there's no us that's arising in that moment. So it's a very, very clear, very simple relationship. He's really pointing toward this quality of very deep, abiding stillness and quiet. Stillness that's not dependent on whether there's noise or not. A stillness that's unshakable, and yet so full and so encompasses everything that nothing is left outside of it. And he's also pointing to the simplicity of the practice, that there's nothing that needs to be added. You don't have to go and learn deep states of concentration. You don't have to obtain meditative accolades. It's just a simple, just simply this. In the seeing, there's only the seeing. And points to how close this quality of stillness is. It's much closer than we ever imagine. We really keep ourselves away from it, but it's immediately available in this very moment. Now, for most of us, when we hear that in the seeing, there's only the seeing, that's not really our experience. And it's more like in the seeing, we create our whole world. We hear something, some reaction, something we react to, and we just build this whole world of our minds. So this could be any sensegate, whether it's seeing or hearing or tasting, touching, smelling, and also thinking. In Buddhist psychology, thinking is considered just very equal with all the other sensegates. And usually what happens is something arises in our consciousness, and then we start to notice whether it's pleasant or unpleasant. If it's pleasant, we want more of it. If it's unpleasant, we want less of it. And we start to really come into the picture, trying to engineer ways to get more of something or try to get rid of it. And we create this quite a bit of friction, all from just a simple touch. It's triggered by this simple point of contact. We create this whole world of thought that fills the space with the world of noise, ideas, and concepts. So we'll come back and tell you what happens to Bahia after hearing this teaching near the end. But for now, let's talk about how it is for us. What happens when we hear a sound? So often when we hear a sound, hear any kind of sense door, it's like a call to action. Okay, I have to do something about this. How rare is it for us just to simply abide with sound, abide with thought, without trying to do something with it, to simply allow it to have its own existence? We come to try to prolong it. We try to get rid of it, enjoy it, push it away, try to ensure that's going to happen next time. There's always this quality of friction with life. This friction is really a defining factor in what keeps us so separate from that basic relationship, that simple relationship between what is seen and the seeing. And we were really involved in that. We're really fighting and struggling with that. And so we look at our world, our sense in the world, and we feel how full it is of struggle and complexity. We look inside our minds and see the internal judging how we look, how we act, how we talk. We look outside and project that on the world around us. And this quality of judgment, the quality of pushing against life. You know, it's too hot or too cold. If I was only this or that. You know, this longing to go on a vacation, to escape from life. I wish it was Friday, then I could relax. And so the common denominator this comes down to is that something's wrong with this moment. Something needs to be changed. Something needs to be modified or adjusted in this moment's experience. That there's some insufficiency. And this is really the quality of dukkha. So dukkha is the first noble truth. And it's often translated as suffering. But I often like to translate it more as this insatisfactoriness of life. That life is always changing. We build our hopes for happiness on something that eventually will change. And that creates this sense of dukkha, this impermanence, unsatisfactory quality of life. or suffering. Now we can take this quality of this unsatisfactoriness, we can start to break it apart, kind of distill it into three main aspects, kind of working with this sutta. So first is a sense object arising. So what is being seen? And I use seen as a shorthand to imply all those different sense gates. So what is seen? What is being seen? Who is seeing it? And what is the relationship with what is being seen? So this forms this triad of experience that happens so immediately, like almost in a heartbeat. Something arises, we arise with it, and we're trying to change it. We have some friction with that. So much that we take this whole thing as being one thing. It arises independent or dependent upon each other and becomes like this big mass, this like a big knot, kind of like concrete. We look at concrete and see the solidity of it. It's really made up of sand and lime, or sand and concrete and rocks. So there's this quality of this being very, very locked together. And as we go through our life, trying to solve the problems of our day-to-day existence, we take that solidity as being true, when it's really these three parts that have come together. And when we take it as being true, there's a certain logic that comes through that, how we go through trying to fix things. But it's the same logic that created it. It's the same process of this resistance to experience, the sense of I'm resisting it. We start to see, oh, I'm uncomfortable with what's arising. And then we start to judge that. So we create another triad. So triad upon triad. So it's a little bit like if I took a hammer and made a hole in the wall, and I try to fix the hole by using the hammer. I just make the hole bigger and bigger. Okay, so it's like using thought to try to find a way out of thought. In the sutta, Buddha's taking us to a whole different paradigm. And simply in the seeing, there's only the seeing. He's not talking about how to be skillful with what you're seeing. He's not telling you about how to work around it, how to have deep meditative states. It's just that direct, simple relationship to experience. Now this peripheralation of thought has this self-propagating effect. It's like if you've ever seen that Mickey Mouse cartoon, the Fantasia, when he's the sorcerer's apprentice, you know, so he's cast a spell to get the mop to do the work for him. And the mop keeps going. He says, oh, I can't get it to stop, so I'm going to chop it. And it splits into two. And he chops it again, splits into, and he just makes more and more of these mops flooding the basement where he's working. And that's what our mind often does. It tries to use the logic of this triad to try to get rid of it. And we just create this whole world of very thick, convoluted reactivity upon reaction, self-belief upon self-belief. And then we seem so disconnected from the point of contact with the ground, with the earth, with reality. It's really the loss of this world of thought. And then we enter a spouse or a friend or a stranger, and they're coming with this whole set of thinking and this triad of these reactivity that they come to. And no wonder we have so much argument, so much suffering and conflict in the world, because there's not very rare to have that point of contact, really touching what's true. We so much relate from our world of thought, from our world of reactivity, and from our world of self-concept. So now let's explore this triad a little closer and see if we can start to understand it more. So looking at the object. So the object arises. So like there's people singing and music in the background. There's my voice. There's your sensation of touching the mat or chair. So these are all just basic sensations that arise. And if we don't add anything to it, if we don't add our concepts, our judgment, our resistance, it's innately neutral. You know, the awareness doesn't care whether it's something pleasant or unpleasant, something horrific or something wonderful. It's all held in the same state, this broad state of awareness. It simply allows it to be just as it is. But then the mind comes in, this reactivity, the sense of I wanting something to be different than it is. Then we go into this triad, and it starts to form into this much harder position. So meditation has a great benefit for working with this level of the triad. You know, from day one, when we begin the beginning class, we're learning how to touch our breath, make contact with our breath and our body. We're releasing thought. So we're learning how to connect with this moment's experience without adding anything to it. And in doing that, we're starting to learn how to release thought and how to tell whether we're lost in thought or connected to experience. We start to be able to tell when we're thinking and when we're not thinking. We start to realize we don't have to believe everything that we think, including these deep thoughts about ourselves, these beliefs about ourselves and others. So this sense of the object arising, so this sense of form, this sense of experience, so it could be anything from a very subtle experience, like a wisp of breath across your face, to a thought, to a much more enlarged concept. But all these we have the ability to soften and just allow it to be just as it is. Now when something arises in our experience, then there's our relationship to it. How are we relating to it? On the most core basic level, we can talk about Vedana. Vedana is the Pali word for feeling tone. If you remember the Satipatthana Sutta, we talked about how that's the quality of being pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. That each experience has one of those three qualities. But it's interesting that it's not universal. You know, you can hear this music in the background, and some people may say, that's, you know, beautiful. And other people may find a lot of irritation from the same point of contact. And what's fascinating, as you practice, you start to find that what you find unpleasant starts to really change. That you find there's much more neutrality in your experience. As you start to soften your reactivity, your tendencies toward reactivity, the identification with yourself, you start to see that experience becomes much more neutral, much more easy. So from this quality of Vedana, we go into aversion and craving. It's kind of the main relationships to life. Now here things really start to get cooking. Okay, we really start to get engaged with that. Because there's a sense of something, we don't like something. We really are not wanting it to be as it is. Or there's something we really like, we want more of it. And there's definitely someone who's coming into the picture. There's a sense of I not wanting this. I want to get rid of it. I don't want it ever to come into my life again. I'm going to figure out how to never have talk to so-and-so and so, so it never arises again. Or is something that's pleasant? How can I keep having more and more of it? How can I fantasize about having that come into the future next time? So when we start to do this, we're really moving away from this simple, isn't the scene, there's only the scene. We're shifting from this quality of just allowing experience to be just as it is, to really taking a stance. And what happens is we actually go away from the object, we actually go back to the object. Not in terms of just allowing it to be as it is, but this is the problem. This thing is what's causing my suffering, or this thing is causing my happiness. So then the strategies that we mostly live our lives are trying to engineer around mitigating the unpleasant and enhancing the pleasant. So at this point, we have to come to a certain spiritual maturity in our practice, in our life. That we stop looking at the objects of our life, the circumstances, the situations as being the cause of our suffering, and realize it's really the relationship that we have with those experiences. It doesn't matter what is arising in this moment. It's how we are relating to it. And the more tension, the more resistance we have toward experience, the greater the suffering is. But it's actually quite good news, because that means that no matter what arises, we have the ability to relax, to work with our relationship to it, how much resistance we have. And meditation really cultivates that, relaxing with the difficult, you know, from a physical discomfort of the knee, to emotions in the body, can we relax and soften to that, avoid the tendency, or at least the tendency to go into thought and come back into this body. So really, that capacity deepens and builds as we practice. So this triad, we're starting to become a little bit more aware of the components. The more conscious we are of the components, the less it drives us, the less it holds us. But sometimes life just really grabs us, we just get yanked right into this sense of the triad, that there's no differentiation between us and what we're mad about or angry about or afraid of. and the object, the thing that we're focusing on. This earlier this year, I've been working at this office for 7 years, or actually 13 years, and it became this, I may have lost my lease. I didn't know for a month or so. And just the amount of uncertainty that came up, the fear of the future, it was very humbling to feel how much I felt, you know, the ground swept out from underneath me. Very hard just to access the body, that the mind just became so caught up in the emotions and the anxiety and fear of the future for a few days. It was very difficult to connect with the body. So it can feel like it's like a runaway train, that our minds and our emotions are just carrying us away. So meditation comes in again to help us learn to connect with the body, connect with something grounded, come in through the body ground so we have a place to stand. Because all our problems, you know, whether it's something like a lease or something like, you know, a loss, where does it exist other than in our thoughts? You know, in this very moment, it doesn't exist except if we think about it, we bring forth that. It was very interesting to reflect on, to see that the great worry was all based in my thinking of the future. But in this moment, everything was fine, in this very moment. So again, we can see how the practice carries us through here. Another reflection that can be very helpful, when we're caught in this kind of the sense of triad, it just seems so heavy and so important, is to reflect on our death. You know, Carlos Castaneda, one of his books, recommended to use death as an advisor. Imagine that death is just off your left shoulder, about ready to touch you. And when you have a concern in your life, to turn and ask your death advice. You know, how important is this in the presence, in the reality that I will die someday? And so much of that's trivial gets dropped away. I mean, so many things that we get so obsessed about, we go so worried about, do they even matter in a year's time, in a month's time, in a day's time? But in that moment, we get so caught up. So there's this sense of investigation and reflection that can come in to help us let go of this ensnarled, tightened constriction. Because trying to undo this knot sometimes can, especially with the contraction of the mind, is like tightening a knot. It just gets tighter and tighter. So as we go through this triad, we're starting to quiet down more. Things are starting to slow down. Meditation has this quality of slowing down this reactivity so we can start to see things more clearly, start to see the parts separate from each other, and start to turn to the final part of this triad, this sense of I-ness, the sense of who is having this feeling, this reactivity, who's having this issue, what's arising. And we turn to look at the self. You know, we have to have a certain stability of awareness and also a certain ability to be still and to see things clearly. We start to see how much it drives these other two, that our sense of who we are, our history, our memories, really shapes how we view, what things we get irritated about, what things we get fight about, what things we get angry about. So as we look at this one, this sense of self as this third triad, let's first talk about it from the quality of the story, the personal story, the sense of who we take ourselves to be. These are the thoughts, the ideas, the deep concepts we take to be true about who we are. Often it takes the form of, I am inadequate, I am unlovable, I'm a failure, I'm ugly, I'm this or that. We all have this core sense of pain. Now as we look at this, as we start to open to that, we want to do it with a quality of deep compassion and non-violence toward what's being seen. Because if we start to go in there with a hammer, we're just making more holes in that. You know, we can make a big mess. So a beautiful way to do it is to just do nothing with it, really. Just to try to see it as deeply as you can, to try to understand it. Because any tendency to try to get rid of it, to try to judge it and fix it, you're back to Mickey Mouse with the brooms. Okay, you're creating this big world of thought. So as we look at this thought, we start to see it. Actually, we see how it creates this kind of deep sense of self-belief. It creates a prism that we look through the world at. So imagine that I gave you each a pair of glasses that was blue tinged. So we look around the world, it's like the world looks pretty blue. Everything looks blue through it. So the same thing is if we take a set of glasses, like I'm inadequate. So everything I look at, it really biases how I see the world. It kind of predisposes me to interpret experience to reinforce that inadequacy. Remember years ago, back at Keystone, really getting connected with this sense of inadequacy for myself, becoming really sensitive to the subtle flavors of how it would manifest in my interactions, in my mind, and just trying to, as much as I could, relax with it. I noticed how much, once I started to deepen with the consciousness of it, it was amazing how much it prevailed my experience. The phone could ring, and I'd pick it up expecting rejection. I'd open the post office box and expect some kind of criticism coming in. So it's really reinforcing this core belief. Anything that supports it, we take it on. Yeah, that's true. I'm an inadequate person. Anything that negates that, we throw it away. We disregard the evidence. We don't throw out the theory. So becoming conscious of these deep qualities of pain is very important for us to start to become, to make space in this triad, this sense of object and us and the relationship. Because if this sense of deep personal pain is not fully seen and explored, it's going to keep coming back. And that's one of the patterns that we just have to keep working with until it's fully seen and fully allowed. So it can be seen just as it is. So as we go even deeper into this sense of self, this sense of perspective, so we went from the sense of who we take ourselves to be to the very sense of orientation, of separateness, that there's me and you. There's a sense of separation and distance. I look out and I see distinction instead of seeing the oneness. So as we look at that, we start to see that the sense of self is really, its main purpose is to somehow deal with this basic uncertainty of life. That life has these basic, it's uncertain, there's a sense of lack of control. The sense of self tries to come in to find a way to make that safe, to have a quality of protection, safety, and control through what's uncontrollable. So certainly the self has a utility. That's how we get through the world, how we keep ourselves safe in the world. But it's not the whole picture. And it becomes very limiting as we start to look at a sutta like this, when the instructions are in the seeing, there's only the seeing. There's no space for that protection. So this protection, this sense of trying to mitigate, control, manage, combat, really the three characteristics. Okay, characteristics of anicca, so impermanence, that everything is changing under our feet, whether it's our bodies, our relatives, you know, our friends, our loved ones. Everything is always in a state of flux. And how we build, it's basically building sandcastles for our happiness, ignoring the fact that the waves will come in eventually and take that away. So the sense of self rebels against that and tries to somehow control it and mitigate it, saying, can I keep, if I go fast enough, if I think enough, if I react enough, can I avoid that reality that things will change, including me? The second characteristic is the one of dukkha, the sense of unsatisfactoriness. You can see impermanence and unsatisfactoriness are very interconnected. This quality that things that we suffer, that we have pain in our lives, that this we will get sick, we'll be age, we will die. This basic reality. And then finally anatta, the quality of non-self, the basic characteristic that there's no distinct self, it's just this conglomeration of memory, of thought, of body, that comes together creates this thing we call us. But that's also something that's an illusion. So that really gets the sense of self going to try to keep itself employed. And the principal way that self does it, the sense of I should say, does this, is by weighing experience. Okay, weighing experience in piles of stuff that's good and stuff that's bad. Okay, so we often, in meditation, we learn how to soften that and make that much more, not so gross, not so big. We learn to soften our reactivity. But we also make it much more refined. Okay, it's like if I get lost in my thought, that's bad. If I stay in my breath, that's good. If I'm falling asleep during meditation, that's a bad sitting. If I'm fully awake and alert, that's a good sitting. You can see how we're just taking the same process of craving and aversion and making it more refined. And this is a principal way that the self works. So anytime there's that basic friction, that this is acceptable and this is not acceptable, that friction means that we are arising in that moment, arising with that sense of friction. So releasing the friction releases the self. So this means that there's no place we can call home. We can't have this sense of orientation that this is where I am. This is a distinct part of who I am and my place. In an absolute sense, there's a relativeness of it, that I know how to drive home, I know how to say hi to my wife, I know all those things, how to do my job. But there's this absolute perspective that we're talking about now. Going toward, in the scene, there's only the scene. Joseph Goldstein has this phrase, that cling to nothing as I, me, or mine. And it's another way of saying what we've been talking about. Anything that we identify as I and cling to it, and then we have this separation. We're far from, in the scene, there's only the scene. Anything we label as mine, as me, each of those creates this sense of separation. Now, as a meditator, especially if you've been meditating for a while, there's a way that there's a sense of ownership that we start to take to our practice. You know, I'm a good meditator. I can sit very steadily. I can go into deep levels of concentration. I can handle anything my mind brings forth. I know the skillful means to it. I've studied all the suttas. I understand, have a lot of knowledge, a lot of ownership to that. But in the seeing, there's only the seeing, there's no space for that ownership. That itself has to be relinquished. We have to give up our identification with us as a spiritual person, as a person who's more evolved or accomplished. So we'll go back to look at Bahia. So what's one of the striking things about this story is that he was willing to do that. He was worshipped. He had, you know, people said, you're really good. You know, I want to hear from you. I want to give you food. But to be willing to give up that, to say, I'm going to go and pray to this, or not pray to this, but ask the teaching from this Buddha. It shows a level of sincerity and commitment. And there's also an urgency, a deep urgency that he felt in that moment when he went to seek the teaching from the Buddha. Because when we get down to it, we have to really surrender, is all that is left, is to surrender our desire to control, our desire to know, to open to the unknown, to open to the deep stillness. So there's not a hair's breadth between ourselves, between experience and awareness. Not even the space of the perspective of us has to come forth. So as you recall from the beginning, Bahia traveled to listen to the Buddha. And after the third time of begging him, the Buddha said, in the seen there's only the seen, in the heard only the heard, in the sensed only the sensed, in the cognized only the cognized. Then there is no you in terms of that. When there is no you in terms of that, there is no you there. When there is no you there, you're neither here nor yonder, nor between the two. This, just this, is the end of suffering. So this takes us beyond where our effort, our will, and our intention can take us. We have to, it's a different a way of, we have to finally let go of that desire to be something other than we are. And it's not actually going anywhere other than this moment, simply opening to this moment in such a deep way. Our sense of ownership can't go there. Our sense of who we are can't go there. That sense of identity has to dissolve. So we have to be willing for our insights and our wisdom to dissolve the sense of self, so it's not taken as being true. And through wisdom and insight, we release ourselves into only the seen. So after hearing the Buddha, Bahiya awakened, became completely liberated. And then shortly after that, I think within a few hours, a cow and a calf trampled him to death. So his life ended. So remember that urgency that he felt. So as we look at our own lives, how much time do we really have? There's no guarantees that life will continue on for the next so many years. And all that is needed is this deep quality of, just like Bahaya, this deep quality of urgency and sincerity. Sincerity to release our what we know, our sense of who we take ourselves to be, even as a spiritual sense. That is all that is needed. In the closing, I'd like to end with what the Buddha said upon hearing that Bahaya had died. Where water, earth, and wind have no footing, there the stars do not shine, the sun is not visible, the moon does not appear, darkness is not found. And when a sage, a Brahmin through wisdom, has known this for himself, then from form and formless, from bliss and pain, he is freed. Can we sit for a few minutes? In hearing, there's only the hearing. Okay, thank you. So we have a chance for a few questions. Yes. So the question is, when there's contact with experience and vedana happens, the quality of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, does a sense of self arise with that, or is it something that comes a little bit later? So it's classically, if you look at dependent origination, it happens after the feeling tone. So it's like there's a sense that arises, then there's the quality of pleasant or unpleasant, neutral. And then when craving, going to craving and aversion, that's when we start to go down the path of being born into this sense of identity. But I think it's the vedana is such a subtle quality of experience that pleasant or unpleasant gets really connected with aversion and craving. It's really hard to see the distinction between that. So often something comes and we don't like it. It's unpleasant, we don't like it right away. It's like it's almost immediate. And then we're already going into, I am not liking it. I don't want it. So I think it's, if it's, you're very still, you might be able to have that quality of unpleasantness or pleasant, you know, Vedana purely without the sense of I arising. But it comes very quickly on the heels of that. And also it's very interesting how Vedana seems to be modified by how basically that if you look at dependent origination, the sense the ground that it comes from, ignorance or wisdom. The more ignorant we are, the more we believe in the sense of self, the more we're invested and identified in that, the more likely it's going to bias how we take things, how our sense gates react to things. So the question is, if you find yourself starting to go down that slippery slope, can you pull yourself back out? Or you can you lean back from, go back from the Vedana? Well, absolutely. It's wherever you catch it. You know, classically, the feeling tone is the weakest part of the link of dependent origination. But any place you catch it, I mean, you could be fully, you know, I'm really upset at that person. It's like, oh, okay. Right in that moment, I can release it. So that's the saving grace of it. And it's often not. It can be counterproductive to go back through and say, okay, well that was which Vedana was that? You know, because you start to you can think about it too much. It's really coming to that immediate reaction or immediate relationship to experience. In the seen is only the seen. In the being angry, there's only the being angry. And the being a sense of self, there's only the sense of self, right? It's because there's no problem with the sense of self arising, it's just whether there's an unconsciousness to it. Yes?
Would you distinguish the three points of the triad again, please?
So the question is, will I distinguish the three points of the triad? So there's an object that's arising in consciousness. Could be sight, hearing, taste, touch, or thought, smell. Any one of those, there's a sense of who is experiencing that, and then there's a relationship between the three, between the object. So there's an object, there's who's experiencing it, and how is that person relating to it. So often when I do mentoring with people, redirecting things can be into one of those three can be very helpful, because often people come with this problem like, when I sit, you know, I had this struggle going on and I don't know how to fix it. And I say, well, look at the relationship you have with it. Forget about what's the object that you're concerned about and notice the relationship that you have with that object. That often frees it up quite a bit. And then if, depending on the student, you can also say, well, look at who is upset about this. Who is not wanting this to be as it is? But we have to come, this sense of investigation has to have this quality of complete allowance. We can't go through, use our awareness as a way to try to, I'm going to judge more subtly what's going on. I have to be able to allow it to be just as it is. So we're always going back to that. Okay, softening my reactivity. You're welcome. Yes.
So, where does action come in? It seems like if you're abiding, it's the moment. I know I heard this about this. It seems like it becomes immobile, just abiding.
So the question is about action. Where does action come in? Because it can sound like when we're just abiding with experience very simply, we're kind of frozen. Can't really do anything about it. So it's a very good question, and it's a question that the mind often comes up with. My mind comes up with that too. It's like, well, what about this scenario or that scenario? Okay, how do I if I'm just seeing it, and seeing there's only the scene, what if a truck's about to hit me? You know, what do I do there? So it's a question of relative versus absolute. Okay, so there's a relativeness of action of knowing what to do. So we don't give up the ability to do that. In fact, in a lot of ways, it's enhanced because it's not so driven by our reactivity. Usually, how we act in the world isn't, you know, it's more like I get hurt here and I punch back, and it's verbally, emotionally, there's this constant trying to alleviate the pain that's being felt. Okay, so we start to quiet that down. We allow things to be just as they are. We can say, okay, this is a more skillful response, and then it transcends, starts to become more of a trusting the spontaneous arising of action. Because usually we think, okay, should I do this option or this option or this option? But there's a growing trust of like, okay, I just opened to the stillness, and this is the right action that comes forth. So you could become out of the driver's seat more and more as you trust that. Okay, good. Yes. Sure. So the question is, how do you, pairing that last question, how do you work with it in a relationship, especially when the other person isn't just trying to release and abide, but still really engage and wants to fight? And is that some prayer? Well, it's actually, it works very well. Okay. So my wife's here, so I'll talk about her. So there's every now and again we have something we disagree about. So we have a conflict, and sometimes it can feel very urgent and very real, and when we're both caught in that, it doesn't go anywhere, because just like we just want to fight, and I say something and she says something back, and it just escalates, and we just get further and further entrenched in our own pain that's not being felt, and we're speaking out and causing pain in that person, and it just goes back and forth. And so in that instance, when one of us has enough quality of centeredness, it's like, this is just not working, we shift into this other mode, and that's just of listening. Of simply, okay, tell me what's going on with you. And you say, well, I think you're being a jerk, and this and that. And you just reflect back. I think you think I'm being a jerk. Okay, so you allow the person to really have their feelings. So suddenly you're holding their pain as well, and suddenly things start to soften and deepen. Because how many arguments and fights we have are really not about what we're fighting about. Have you noticed that when you finally get down to it, when you finally listen to each other, you realize, oh, it's this pain from childhood stuff, or child of feeling rejected, and I just wanted you to wash the dishes, but there's that stuff gets it's we're laughing, but that's it happens. There's this this deep level of pain, so it allows us to really connect with that. So it's really we're the same process of how we work with our own mind, our own emotion, is how we work with theirs. Simply allowing them to be just as they are. And it's an exercise that Rodney gave Ann and I before we got married, is to do this exercise of listening to each other. That one person gets to speak, another one just reflects, paraphrases it. The other person says, "Yeah, you got it right, or you didn't get it right." And we, at first we were doing that for one person would talk for like an hour. We had a lot of backlog of stuff, and then the other person would talk. But it's the one thing that really gets us out of those really difficult situations. So we're balancing the absolute with the relative. How can we work relatively with this person, with each other, with ourselves, but also have this absolute quality of everything is held? Any other questions? Yes, Suze.
When you said about that there is no home.
Yes. So the question is, in the talk I spoke around that there is no home. There's no place we can claim as home. That we often build our hopes for happiness on, you know, like building a sandcastle. But where is their home? Where is the place of rest? And it's a beautiful question, because from as each of our practices, we start to come to this question of anatta, of the sense of self. Okay, at first it can be really scary. It can really freak us out, because we hear things like, there's no home. I want to have a home. I want to have the stability of life. And it becomes, there's a lot of fear that comes up with that. But once we start to go through that and start to see that self, sense of self, is just another thought that arises, and we start to see that there's something else that holds it, we realize that quality of stillness, the quality of emptiness, the quality of non-self, of abiding awareness, is the safest thing in the world. Because you give up this kind of, you give up a little castle for really everything. I mean, there's a deep abiding, that there's nothing left outside your heart, outside your mind. So the home becomes wherever you are, whatever the circumstances. You're welcome. Yes.
In the triad that you describe, self, object, relationship, what part did it with that? Is that the relationship itself, or is that represented by the triad?
So the question is, in the triad of object, self, and relationship, where does the heart fit into that? Is it represented by the relationship, or is it not part of that? So it depends what you mean by the heart. Do you mean like the? What do you mean by the heart? Loving kindness, the quality of friendliness. The quality of heart can be part of that triad. In terms of, if we're trying to work with it skillfully. Because, you know, most of us are trying to, you know, that triad's still arising. There's still us, there's what we're seeing, but we're trying to, you know, work with it in a nice way, trying to allow things to be as they are, trying to open our heart to it. So then the quality of heart's coming in. But ultimately, the heart isn't really part of that whole triad. Because in the seen, there's only the seen. The heart, you could say, is what is seeing it. The heart is what's holding awareness. You know, heart is another way you could say of abiding awareness, of this of pure awareness. So it in a lot of ways it's what allows us to start to also allows us to wake up from the triad too. This quality of the heart saying this like this woman's question about the relationship. This pain doesn't feel good. It doesn't feel good to be keep hurting myself and others. That's the heart speaking, saying that this what the mind is doing isn't making sense. The world of thought isn't making sense. So let's switch to a different paradigm, and that's the paradigm of the heart. Questions? Okay, it kind of feels like we're kind of at a good stopping spot. So Linda asked me to make an announcement that Rodney and Narayana's retreat, the week long in June 8th to the 15th, is now almost full. But since nowadays there is usually several cancellations for the retreat, especially right immediately before the retreat, you're encouraged to get on the wait list as soon as you can, so you have a good chance to attend. And so that's a very delightful week long. I've done many of those with Rodney and Narayana and other teachers. It's a cloud mountain, so it's only about 2.5-3 hour drive. Beautiful setting. So if you're interested in doing a longer retreat, that's a nice one to do it. It's 7 days. It's not that strenuous. Okay. All right. Any last questions? Does anyone? Yes. So the question is about using death as an advisor, and how is it not using a hammer or using an intellectual tool? Well, it depends how you use it. You know, what's calling to is simply to have a bigger perspective. And so death is definitely a big gun in spiritual practice, that it can bring up a lot of anxiety, a lot of fear, a lot of tension. You know, regrets about how our life has been, fear of our own deaths. So if that comes forth, then it's probably not a good tool at this point. But the way it's intended is along this question of where the heart comes in. Because if you think about if you were on your deathbed, or if you were like Bahia, and you knew that today was your last day, you know, how would that change your urgency for practice? How would it change your urgency for just simply connecting with people? I mean, your to-do list would vanish. What you're going to do, your long-term goals wouldn't make any sense anymore. The struggle over your lease doesn't matter. So it brings a deep perspective, a deep kind of a reality check about what we get so caught up in. It's a way to help interrupt that. But it is a very powerful tool. And I think that the Buddha said that of all the paths of practice, that's the biggest. It's the most profound. Any other questions?